My name's Judy, I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome everybody here tonight. This is an awesome opportunity for us to all be together. And the good news is that everybody that's in this room tonight is here because they were intended to be here. So whoever you're sitting next to, turn to them and welcome them, if you would. So before we move on to introducing our speaker who has come from Richmond to be with us tonight, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you a little bit about the Simple Actions Group and Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of us who would like to join us, we will start our meeting here with a moment of silence, and then we're going to say the Serenity Prayer together. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to everyone here this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use the rest of this room and the restrooms, which are just across the hall and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, if you would, please silence any cell phones or other noisy devices. And we'd also like to ask that you, out of respect for the speaker, please try to minimize any movement around the room. So if you do want to get coffee or anything, if you do that now, so that we won't have any interruptions. This group practices the spiritual foundation of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I'm now going to read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study, and on the other weeks, as David mentioned earlier tonight, we go through each of the steps through the big book with a panel of two guests. But tonight, we have a special guest. This is our special supper and a speaker event, and he'll be sharing his story with us tonight. And Justin has been on our table before, and we were looking so forward to have him here with us. And he did come from Richmond, so please do give him a warm welcome. Justin.
Thanks, Judy. Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? I'm going to make this thing here. Is that better? Okay. Thank you so much, Judy, and thank you, David, for inviting me out. My name is Justin. I'm an alcoholic. we almost missed supper because John, you know, he almost got us lost on the way. And I thought, you know, this is your home group. You should know the way. No, thank you, John. Once I told him that I was coming to the Simple Actions Group and I was going to be speaking, he was so excited, he jumped on, he said, "When? I'm there." And I love seeing that kind of enthusiasm, so I automatically have a lot of respect for the guy, and he thank you for driving us, I appreciate it, John. And Blue came up with me at the last minute, and you know, love having him here too, and thank you so much for the warm welcome and the hospitality. This place is—it feels like home, even though I've only been here twice. It feels like one of the best AA places where you can go, where you know you're going to get a message, where you know that you're going to get the fellowship, the recovery. I could have never imagined that before. There was a time, you know, and you know, like we're supposed to tell our story, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, and I would have never envisioned a place like this, or you know, standing up in front of a crowd and being able to tell the story in the events that come to play that bring us into a place where we you know, lose the obsession and the craving. You know, there was a time when I couldn't get a day, you know, and that's, you know, I just resigned to the fact that maybe this is it, you know, this is as good as it's going to get. I'm going to wake up, fight drinking for about 2 or 3 hours, and I'm going to have to cave in and drink and, you know, pretty much muscle through the day as best as I can until I pass out, black out, or wind up in jail. And those are the only ways I stopped drinking. And it's been that way since I was about 13 years old, but I'm going to jump right into it. And, my home group is Jaywalkers in Richmond. We meet on Tuesdays and Fridays at 7 o'clock on Huguenot Road at Bonner Presbyterian Church. David comes out and he told his story, I guess, maybe 2 months ago, and it was great. I love it. And we love having you. We're going to probably have you back next year for sure. Tuesdays we have a big book study where we read through the big book, you know, in a linear fashion. So Friday night's a speaker meeting, and that's been my home group for the last 10 years. My sobriety date is February 7th of 2008, so if you're quick at math, you realize that I didn't stay sober the whole time since I was in there. And that wasn't my first attempt at sobriety either. I originally got sober in 1995, and through another fellowship, because I really didn't think drinking was a problem. I thought everybody drank in the morning, everybody blacked out, you know, at least 2 or 3 times a week. And, you know, I never stole to drink, you know. Until I did my 9th or 8th step, and I realized I stole a lot of liquor in order to drink. But, you know, alcoholism was definitely a prevalent fact in my life ever since I was, you know, a wee child, I guess. You know, I stole my first beer out of my grandfather's refrigerator. It was a Schaefer. I don't know if anybody remembers Schaefer or Schlitz, you know. Schlitz, you know, one of those. You know, and I didn't get anything out of that. Nothing. And my grandmother, she had creme de menthe, and I thought that looked really pretty, green liquid, you know. Of course, the kid's going to drink that, and that didn't, you know. But, my, you know, I'm going to back up and just kind of give you a brief history of my childhood. My parents, they were children of Woodstock, and, you know, I was born about 11 months after Woodstock. So, you know, evidently they might have been a little bit too out of it to make things happen on at Woodstock, but I guess they got it together a couple months later. But not too long after that, they divorced when I was 3, and, you know, my father moved out to Spain for a year, and when he came back, he moved to Lynchburg, Virginia, and that's kind of roundabout way how I ended up in Virginia. My mother still lives up in Connecticut, where I was born and raised, and, Fordham Prep. Where is he, Ralph? There he is. I grew up 30 minutes away from where Ralph thought I grew up, and he thought I went to Fordham Prep with him, and I said, no, I'm 30 minutes north of there. But where I grew up, it was a middle-class neighborhood. My grandparents, my grandfather was a World War II veteran. And the reason why I say that is because my grandparents were a big part of my life. After my parents divorced when I was 3, we moved in with them for a couple of years, and until my mother met my stepfather, and when I was 5 or 6. So I can remember, preschool and kindergarten, you know, and my grandfather and my grandmother, and she always had that glass of scotch, and she would look out the picture window in the living room, and she would always have that cheerful, rosy cheek, you know, thing going on at 3:30 in the afternoon, and while she's drinking her scotch and getting dinner ready, and she made 5 meals, and she made them perfect, you know. And it was like every Sunday we were going to get one of those 5 meals. And so that's how we grew up. And I played sports, and I played around the block. We played kickball, tag, army in the woods, all the stuff that kids do, and it was a happy childhood. My father, when he moved back to the country, he moved back to Lynchburg, like I said. And, you know, up until I was about 10 or 11, I didn't spend a whole lot of time seeing him. So most of my memories were around my grandparents' house. And when we moved out, it's when my mom got remarried to Carl, who's a Vietnam vet, and he was like my next father figure for the next 9 years. And what that was like was awesome. I mean, you know, he introduced me to a lot of sports. You know, we moved into a house in Stamford, Connecticut, in the town next door where I grew up, and I met, you know, had a lot of fun with my friends. And but through that whole process, I'd ended up going to 3 different elementary schools, 2 different middle schools. We called them junior high there, and then ended up going to 2 high schools. When my mother got cancer when I was about 13, I had experimented already. I had taken, you know, I'd smoked some marijuana, you know, and it was easy to get that as a 13-year-old. And that white powdery substance that was floating around, because, you know, not too far away from Fordham Prep, they used to have some easy access places for that. For a 13-year-old, it was easier to do that than grab a six-pack. But what happened was I went to this party. We moved back into Old Greenwich when my mom got cancer. She split up with my stepfather. And there was a lot of fear behind that, because she didn't really work at that time. She had a career, but she I could feel the nervousness. I could feel that she was scared, and I was scared, because she's all I had, because I didn't have a relationship with my dad. I mean, I'd see him on Christmas. I'd see him, you know, for a week, 2 during the summer, but we weren't close, and I didn't feel much, you know, like I... He got remarried when I was 10, and I have a half-sister, and she got all the attention. So, you know, my 4 steps are already building. They separated. They got a divorce. My stepsister got all the attention. You can see where this is going, why I drink. You know, like a good alcoholic, I'm building up my case of why I'm about to do what I'm about to do, you know. And I've got a reason for it, and it's you. So... when the day came and I finally found alcohol at its glory, I was at Karina Robinson's house. We had just moved back into Old Greenwich. I came from an inner city school in Stamford, where all the kids were wearing parachute pants and fat lace Adidas and breakdancing. And, you know, and I'm going in there and I'm like, you know, all thumbs, and these kids are all, you know, real preppy. And this is the town I grew up in, but I'd been away for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And you know, obviously, I needed to go back to the department store. And I said, Mom, we got to go to the store. I got to get new clothes, you know, because I had to fit in, you know. And that's the one thing I knew how to do, was just try and fit in as quick as possible. And that's what I did. I got Peter and Paul. They were my best buddies. And we started to, you know, do bong hits before school. And that helped me cope quite a bit until I could find other solutions. And, you know, once we got to the A&P, which is like a Kroger, we used to wait outside. Or maybe I did, I don't know, I can't remember. There might have been somebody else with me, I can't remember. But I used to wait with $5 that I stole from my mom's purse, and I would wait until somebody cool like this guy would walk up, and I'd say, hey, will you give me a six-pack, you know? And he'd be like, yeah, sure, kid, you know. And I'd go run off behind Kroger or A&P, and I'd drink that six-pack with my buddy. And eventually it got to, you know, where we got a little bit more courage. And we'd go in there and we'd just, you know, grab a 30-pack of Milwaukee's Beast and run out, you know, because we could run fast at 13. And they couldn't catch us. And so we'd run off and through the woods, cut down through the street, and we'd walk over to the river, and we'd get drunk. And then I'd stumble home, lose my shoes, and come back, pass out on the couch. And that's how I showed up when I was about 13 and 14. And I cut my teeth into good drink, and then when I was about 14, 15, I started to caddy in the summer at this country club, Millbrook Country Club. And caddies make good money. For a 14-year-old, you can walk away with $100 at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. And back in 1985, you can get a lot for $100, you know. And that was on, like, member guest tournament days, of course, you know. But the thing that really appealed to me about Millbrook Country Club was that there was, you know, Richie, and then there was a couple other, Alan, who was old hippie Alan, and Richie, he always came in with pop-off vodka. So we used to sit in the cart shack right across from the caddy shack after we, you know, sign in, and they, you know, assign us our players. We'd go hang out in the caddy shack. And I'd hang out with the guys who were about 3 times my age, about 45 years old. Most of them were homeless, living in halfway houses or hanging out in the park, drinking their lives away. And that's what I wanted to do, because it looked pretty cool, you know. So I'd hang out with Richie and Alan, and Alan always brought the pot, and Richie always brought the pop-off vodka. And the funny thing is, though, is Richie would, you know, he'd start to drink, but, you know, he was already tanked from the last 2 days of drinking. So by the time he teed off with his players, they'd usually have a call into the caddy shack, and the caddy master would get a phone call. Yeah, Richie's passed out on the third fairway. Go get the golf cart and pick him up. And, you know, so I'd go grab his pop-off and finish it off for him. And afterwards, what we'd do is we'd celebrate. We'd go to the corner store, and we'd get an oil can of Foster's. You know, oil can of Foster's lager, right? Just remember to make sure you guys were drinkers, you know. So I'd get that, and that would chase down the pop-off vodka. So, I mean, for $5, I'd get the $2.25 would cost a pint of pop-off vodka, and the oil can of Foster's was $2.25 and a pack of Marlboro Reds, and I was a grown man. I was well on my way to maturity. So we'd go to the park, and we'd drink. And I met this guy named Zane, and he had this stuff called Thorazine. And Zane was really crazy. He was living in a halfway house, you know, and we'd play Frisbee, and we'd start drinking and smoking, and you know, and I'm the youngest by far. You know, they've all got me by about 20, 30 years. But all my buddies are walking down the street past the park, and I'm getting, you know, I'm having a great time. But none of the other kids my age are doing that, you know, at 2 o'clock on a Saturday. But that's what I did every Saturday and Sunday, at every chance I could get. But so by the time I was 15, I was really adept at trying to find ways to drink. And if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And, you know, other substances played a good part in my life. You know, I tried to control my drinking through LSD, marijuana, whatever other drug you had. And I would kind of do that little, you know, roulette. You know, you never knew if it was going to land on black or red. You know, whichever day, whatever you had in your pocket really was what I was going to do that day. But, you know, I tried to stay away from those addictive drugs, so I drank most of the time. And what happened was I got turned on to some of that hippie music, you know, when I was about 15. And, you know, heavy metal was not cool, you know. We went to Grateful Dead shows at 15, 16 years old, and then that's where I kind of found my home, because there was a lot of love there and a lot of, you know, just you can't remember what you did the night before, but it was fun, you know, and a lot of colorful things in between. So I loved it. I found, you know, I met this girl. She was 19. By the time I was a junior in high school, I was a full-fledged deadhead. And I used to go to these shows with my friends, and we would just plan. I mean, we didn't even go to school. We would go to school to exchange, you know, party favors and find out when the next show was and where to get tickets and talk about the last ones we went to. And because it was a great escape, and that's what I did. That's what my drinking did. It gave me the great escape from boredom, from fear, from worry, from resentment, from whatever, you know, it was a great time filler, you know, and it filled a lot of time for quite a while. You know, I have a friend, I'm going to interject real quick. I have a friend who I've been going to meetings. We have the same sponsor, and his story goes like this. He's had the same job for 25 years. He's had his house, his vacation house, and the same wife for the last 20 years, and he never missed a day of work, and he never showed up late. And one day his wife said, "You know what, if you don't stop, I'm out of here." He came into AA, didn't want to get sober, hated people in sobriety, you know, couldn't stand a day without, I mean, drank after the meeting, fought it tooth and nail, but you know how we are, we're persistent about this positive, you know, sobriety actually can be fun, you know. And he's been sober now the same amount of time as I have, and we have this total opposite story thing going on. I take one drink and I'm pretty much homeless, and he, you know, can drink like a fish, and you know it seems like his life doesn't get really affected. But on the inside, it looks the same. You know, on the inside, the loneliness, the despair, the four horsemen, the terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair that we wake up with every morning. That's pretty much a common denominator with most alcoholics who would plan on not drinking the day before but ended up getting hammered like myself. I never really vowed to stop drinking. I vowed to, like, kind of switch tracks on the train, you know, or something like that. But I really, you know, knew deep down inside that, you know, there was something that was way out of control. And this was in my teenage years. I knew that, you know, there was something like a switch that would hit. And that switch would hit every time I took that first drink. I never understood why or how it happened until I came into AA and I was long into my 167th meeting. And I finally opened up and heard the words you guys were saying that this is an allergy. And, you know, the phenomenon of craving actually kicks in after I've taken the first drink. You know, I'm drinking to overcome that craving, but you know, the oxymoron is I drink to overcome the craving, and then when I take a drink, the craving really kicks in. You know, for me, it happens like that. And I get thirstier and thirstier and thirstier until I pass out or, you know, go bye-bye. And when I met Jean, this girl in high school, going back to high school and how I left high school, 16 years old, I guess, we decided we were going to go on tour that spring. And I said, you know what, that's really going to interfere with school, so I might as well just tell my guidance counselor that I'm finished with school. So I resigned and took a sabbatical in my 11th grade year to go sell Mexican blankets and marijuana and other, you know, psychedelics on the road with them. And that's what we did. We had like probably $160 between us, and we took bus tickets down to Carolina and started. And by the time we got back up to Massachusetts, you know, somebody with those three-letter hats was following me, and they knew my name. And the guy that I was getting stuff from, he ended up going away to prison, and I started to get scared, and we ran off and started to live in this state park where no one can find us. And we ended up in Cranberry State Park in upstate Connecticut, living in a tent for the next 3 months. And I don't remember much of it, but things started to go downhill when I could never save up enough money to buy this beat-up old Datsun, you know, that this junkie who used to come hang out in the park and drink with us had. And he said, yeah, I'll sell it to you for $600. But every time I got $599, I'd go out and party, and I'd end up with 10, you know. So, you know, 3 months later, we're still, you know, doing the same thing, trying to figure out how we're going to get our way out of there. You know, the great thing was we're going to move to California where I didn't know anybody. Nobody's going to bother us about how we live and how we party or whatever. And life was going to get better, you know. And thank God it was spring and summertime because, you know, had the weather gotten colder, we'd have probably, you know, got smarter much faster. But, you know, one day I'm high on LSD and my mother comes and my buddy comes up and says, hey, your mom's here looking for you. And I said, she doesn't even know where I am. I hadn't talked to my father in about 2 years, and I told my mother where I was for the past 5 or 6 months. And, you know, at that time I was probably into oblivion and not really caring too much about what was going on around me. I didn't really have the ability to see how I affected other people. I was just living day to day to just feel good. And that's pretty much the extent of it. So when she came, I talked to her. She convinced me to call my father, and I, you know, inadvertently, long story short, she ended up giving me a bus ticket, sending me down to my father's, and I went back to school, and, you know, I pretended to do well. You know, I actually did do well. I got B's and C's in school, and I was showing up for class, but, you know, you put me in any environment, anywhere in the world, and I believe this to be true. You know, untreated alcoholism looks like this. I gravitate towards the people that are just like me. You know, you can change, you know, what state, what town I'm in, you know, what relationship I'm in. And it's just like changing the names and the faces, but the same experience keeps happening over and over again. I don't know if anybody's experienced that, but that's been pretty much the story of my life. So, you know, I found those people. There they were, you know, but they just looked a little bit different, acted a little bit different, but we were the same on the inside, and we knew how to do it. So we'd get up in the morning, and we'd get loaded before school, just like before, and then we'd end up doing the same thing after school. But I was showing up for class because they didn't have smoking sections in this school, and it was much more stringent rules. And so I did end up getting good grades. Long story short, my father had lured me down there, by the way. He lied to me. He lied. And he said, yeah, I've got a car. It just needs a little work. You know, if you want to come down here and work on it, you know, maybe it'll, you know, give you a break from where you've been. I said, wow, what a great guy. He's going to give me a car, you know. I'm 17. Everybody else has got cars. Yeah, I need a car, you know. So I go down there, and that's all I'm thinking about is I'm going to get a car. I don't care about, you know, seeing my dad or anything like that. That's how selfish, you know, I am, because I know that he's probably going to interfere with my plans of, you know, drinking. And all I could think about for the first 4 days, you know, was not, gee, Dad, I haven't seen you in a couple of years. It's so great to see you again. Was, where's the damn car? And I says, well, when are we going to go see that car? Where is it? He says, oh, it's over at the Volkswagen shop. It was a 1968 Volkswagen Bug. And I said, okay, cool. When can we go? We'll go down there tomorrow. So I go over there with him the next day. And we get out there, and I'm looking around. It's like an ocean of Volkswagen Bugs. And it's like, you know, big as this room. And they're lined up all over the place. And I'm thinking, okay, it might be, you know. And I see all these ones. Some of them are cool and really in good shape. And I said, which one is it? He said, it's a light blue one. I'm looking, oh, wow, that one looks good over there. And he says, no, that's not it. I said, well, where is it? He says, oh, wait, there it is. Over there. And I'm looking over there. I said, I don't see any light blue bug. No, over, look past in the bushes over there. And it was like this rusted out piece of crap that had been sitting in the woods for like 5 years. So I'm like, that one? He says, yeah. So I go over there, and as I get closer, I can see something, you know, and it's like, what's in the front seat, you know, and I get up, and the damn motor's in the front seat, and I get closer, and I open up the door, and it creaks, and I look down, and there's trees growing up through the floorboards, and that son of a bitch tricked me. So I got that beat up piece of crap Volkswagen Bug towed back to my dad's house. I didn't speak to him for 2 days. So when he finally got me a climber's manual, you know, one of those manuals, or Chilton's, I can't remember, I guess it's Chilton's manual to fix cars, and, you know, I don't know anything about mechanics. I could change my bike tire, you know, on a bicycle. I know what the tools are and how to use them, but, you know, I don't know anything about how a motor runs or anything like that. So, you know, I said, well, when are you going to help me fix this thing? He says, oh, I'm not. You're going to do it. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, you can do it. I don't know anything about cars. He says, oh, you can do it. So I'm looking through this manual. I'm like, I don't even know where to start. I don't know where to begin, you know. And so he says, well, let's start with this. You know, you need to do floorboards. Let's figure out, you know, can you get the parts for the floorboards? And he showed me that. So anyways, long story short, you know, I get this job. I'm working nights as a dishwasher. I'm saving up all my money working, washing dishes at this Chinese restaurant. I'm the only English-speaking kid in the Chinese restaurant, which makes it good because they can't really bust you for smoking pot because they can't speak your language. So, and you know, anyways, long story short, you know, on the way home, I would pass by Lynchburg College, you know, and as a junior, a repeat junior in high school, nothing is more appealing than sorority girls at 17 years old. I'm like, I'm ahead of the game now, you know. But, you know, I didn't get so lucky all the time. I ended up getting to be like the mascot for this frat house where I would show up and I would drink the beer and they thought it was funny that I'd show up and get loaded. And I would stumble back home and get home around 11 o'clock at night on a school night and, you know, hope that my dad's, you know, asleep already so he didn't see me, you know, ping-ponging across the back hallway back to my bedroom, you know, because I'd kind of do one of those moves, bouncing back from wall to wall. And that's how I managed to get that car together, was I worked every day and, you know, got the parts and, you know, bloody knuckles trying to take those old rusted bolts off and finally got it together, but I couldn't wire it, so we had to take it to this mechanic, and he, you know, hooked up the wiring for me. We finally fired it up, and this was a year later, and it was awesome. It was, like, glorious, you know. Only thing happened that was I didn't put the valve cover cap on tight enough, so I started to drive up to my mom, so I wanted to show her, you know, look at this new car that I built, you know, put new floors, new upholstery, new motor, everything, And I got down to about like halfway to Charlottesville. I'm not even an hour away from Lynchburg where my dad lives. And the oil light's coming on. I'm like, why is this coming on? I'm, you know, and I pull over and almost ran out of oil. I almost blew the car up an hour after I started it. So that's the story of my life right there. That's pretty much it, you know. Redlining all the way and, you know, until everything's just about coming off and coming into pieces. I got the car back up to Connecticut and terrorized my mother for another year. I worked in a restaurant, and I got interested in culinary school, and because I wanted to get out of her house, because she would approach me at drinking, and I could tell you what it looked like in the worst case scenario was when she tried to stop me drinking one night, and she says, you know, you're going to go out with these people again, and I never know when you're going to come home. And she would say, you know, please don't do this, you know. You need to stay home, you know, because when I'd come home to my mom's house, it would look like this, you know. I'd be you know, blackout drunk, and I wouldn't be able to put the key in the keyhole to unlock the front door to get in. So I would pass out on the front stoop. Or I would get the key in the keyhole and I would crawl on all fours up the stairs to our, you know, entrance, because we lived in a condo at that time. And you went up the stairs and there was our door and then someone else's. And some nights I would make it to the top of the steps. And one night when I made it to the top of the steps, she woke up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And she had this funny feeling. So she opened up the door and there I was at the top of the steps. So she's shaking me. She's trying to wake me up. And she says, "What are you doing? What happened?" You know, and she's trying to get me up. And I finally stand up. This is about 20 steps. And you know what happened. You know, I cartwheeled backwards down there and there was a slate tile floor. Of course, I knocked myself out. When I came to, the paramedics were asking me, you know, how many I had. I told them, I said, 2. So she didn't want to have any more of that bullshit. She was like, "I'm done, you know." And that's the way it kind of went. And one night when she tried to stop me, I got rough with her and I took her by the shirt and threw up against the wall, and like a good son would, and said a few kind words and stormed out of the house and broke her heart one more time, you know, like I did all the time. And so anyways, I knew that couldn't continue, and things kind of calmed down for a little while, and I was living there. And what happened was, is I got interested in going to culinary school because I wanted to get out of the house. I wanted to have a career. I wanted to become a chef. You know, because I always had the munchies. I like to eat good food. What happened was, is I looked at this culinary school up in Vermont, and I went up there, and I found out I can get a loan, and my grandparents offered to pay for the second year. If I made it through the first year, they hold the carrot out in front of me. They said, if this loser can make it through the first year, we'll pay for the second year. Otherwise, you're on your own. So I said, fine, I'm all game, you know. And it was a lot harder. I had to show up every day. You know, and I couldn't drink and smoke like I wanted to. I had to actually have all the brain cells intact, you know, to learn. And that was a whole new concept. I hadn't practiced that since probably 6th or 7th grade. What happened was, is I had to really bear down, and I made it through and got my associate's degree 2 years later. And I got a job, and my drinking looked like it was normal. Like I would drink maybe two or three beers with the buddies, and then, you know, settle down and do some homework. And you know, maybe on the weekends I'd have a six-pack or get drunk maybe one night, and then I would recover on Sunday. And maybe smoke a little bit of, you know, the green jeans here and there, and that was it. And 2 years later, I'm getting this diploma and I'm getting this degree or whatever, and I got this job opportunity out in at the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco. And I always wanted to go to California. This was my final ticket to get to California and live the good life that I thought I was going to live when I was 17. And when I got out there, you know, I started working at the Ritz-Carlton, and they moved me from department to department. I spent the first, 6 or 7 months in the garbage department building all these cold platters and stuff like that, pâté and terrines. And they moved me over to the pastry department, where I made like 5,000 pounds of pastry cream and fruit tarts and, you know, enough chocolate mousse to kill an elephant. And I found the people that were just like me. One more time, I was in that place 3,000 miles away, and I found everybody was just like me that worked right in the next apartment over. And we went out and we did what we always do, and we drank till 4 o'clock in the morning. We had a great time doing it, and we drank my buddy right out of his fiance's house, and drank this expensive 1975 Lafitte Chateau Lafitte Rothschild when he decided he was no longer going to get married, and we all cheered him on, like, you know, hey, you know. He was living in a boat across the bay, you know, 6 months later, you know, and that's the life we lived. It looked pretty normal for a little while until about a year and a half, 2 years into that job. I'd gotten a job as a private chef, so I was living in this apartment that was a, you know, salary job. I cooked one meal a week. And I got a free apartment in the Marina District. I was about 3 or 4 blocks up from the Palace of the Fine Arts. I don't know if anybody knows that area. I've been out there, but it's a nice little area. The owner of the San Francisco Giants lived right next door to my boss's house. And he was a real estate broker. And I cooked a meal once a week, every Thursday, for 6 or 7 people, 4-course, sometimes 5-course. And it was rent-free, all my expenses paid, food, beverages, you know. And I had my full-time job at the Ritz-Carlton. I was, you know, catering chef at that time, you know, working in the catering department. And, you know, everything looked so perfect. I mean, on the outside, you know. And what happened was is I decided I was going to invite some people over after I was out partying one night. And, you know, I only invited maybe five or six people, but 70 people showed up in my little 600-square-foot apartment down in the basement. And this was while Lorenzo, the owner, was away. Right, he was away, so when the cat's away, the mice will play. And so I did. And this party lasted till about 2 o'clock the next afternoon. And somebody tried to do some sort of a drug deal there. And I wish they'd have told me about it, because I would have stuck around for some of the goodies. But I left in the morning to go drive around with some people. And when I came back to my apartment, there was about five police cars there. And they hauled me in, and how am I doing on time? 7:34. Okay, we're going to get sober in about 10 minutes. What happened was is that they brought us down and interrogated us. I didn't know anything, and they let us go. And, you know, when Lorenzo came back, my boss, he came back into town. He called me at the Ritz-Carlton. I got a phone call, and I had to go back into the chef's office. I said, yes. He says, get to my house as soon as you finish work. We need to talk. So I knew that wasn't good. So you can tell, you know, I got the boot there. He said that the neighbors were they were really concerned, because there was people passed out on the front lawn. There was people parked perpendicular on the middle of the street, and it was just a wreck. And I couldn't argue with them. You know, I knew I screwed up, you know, so there was no argument. So off I go. I go back to the Mission, and my friends that I'd made in the Mission, the first apartment I lived in was over on 19th and Folsom, above this bar called Donington Park. And so I go back to 19th and Folsom, and I move into my old flat with about four roommates, and they were like, what happened? You had that great gig over there in the marina. What's going on? You were a private chef. What happened? And, you know, I was like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. You know, so already I felt the shame and the guilt of, you know, and I didn't even want to look at why it happened. I just did, you know. So what happened was is I continued to party the same way I partied, and I got involved with some other substances that you know, kind of took place. And what happened was is I stopped showing up for work on time. You know, I'd show up for work maybe an hour or two late, and I got to the point where I was pretty much unemployable, where I wasn't of any use, because I couldn't stop drinking. I'd go out and I'd start drinking, and I couldn't stop. I'd drink until 5-6 in the morning, and I think I'd just take a half hour, 45 minute little cat nap, set the alarm, and I'll get up at 7:30 and I'll make it to work. And I would wake up, and the sun would be blaring through the window, and it's 9 o'clock, and you know, just like my stomach would drop, and I would freak out. So the executive chef there, he called me into the office, and I'd been late probably about 9 times in about 2 or 3 months. And he says, what's going on with you? And he looked really concerned, and he was sincere. He said, what's wrong? And I said, I don't know. And, you know, you ask me why I do what I do and why I can't show up, and I just don't have an answer, you know. And he says, I've got no choice, you know. I've got to let you go. You know, you've company policy, you've gone twice the limit of how many times you can be late. I've got to let you go. I'm sorry. And I can, you know, in my stomach, I got that knot in my stomach. I felt like, you know, just everything crash, you know, and everything I've worked for just boom, you know. And so I go on, and, you know, all I had to do was basically go into any restaurant and tell them I have a degree, and they hired me. And, you know, they didn't know what kind of a loser they were hiring, though, because I would show up, and I was the guy that, you know, the owner would come in the restaurant at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I got a, you know, Heineken on the cutting board, and I'm sitting there getting breakfast ready. And they asked me, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting breakfast ready. And they say, we don't drink here in the kitchen. And I said, well, I guess that means I'm out of here, you know. So I'd walk out and I'd just leave. So pretty much anything that stood in the way of my drinking at that time was, you know, to the wayside. I finally did get a job that I was able to really be successful at, you know, and it lasted a good 2 months. And I started working at 20 Tanks Pub and Brewery. And they had policies that I could agree with. So I stood behind them. They allowed 2 shift beers at lunchtime. You know, so I stuck around. And I muscled it out for 2 months before I became, you know, pretty much a vagrant, homeless, loser on the street, you know, for the next 2 or 3 years. And, you know, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that they talk about in the big book really rings true for me in every aspect. You know, I began to run with the people of ill repute and bad behavior, and I matched and mirrored that all the way down to the bottom. And I skidded along that bottom for as long as I could until I couldn't take it anymore. And then those nice, you know, police officers of San Francisco finally found me in this seedy hotel. And I'd been, you know, waiting in this hotel for my connection to show up, because I was at the end of my run and I just needed something to put me to sleep. And he wouldn't show up at his hotel room, and I'm sitting there waiting, and I'm like, God, you know. And I'll tell you what it's like, you know. The decline happened really fast. I was 23, 20, 24 at the time, and the decline happened so rapid, I didn't even see it. You know, I got involved in all this other stuff, and I was drinking, you know. I'd wake up, and I had about maybe a 10, 15-minute window before I had to have a beer. And it was usually by the time I had my sixth beer, I had the, you know, the courage to, you know, put my shoes on and walk out the door. And usually by the time I walked out the door, there they were, you know, doing the same thing they always do. And we'd go off on another run for 2 or 3 days, and I would show up, and I would sleep in the park during the day, and I would go out and hang out at these bars and these clubs at night, you know. And I'd, you know, I had places to go. I had my stuff stuffed in the garage of a friend of mine who always cleaned up my mess, you know. No matter how far down the scale I went, he always said, yeah, come on in, man, grab a shower and stay here the night, you know. And I'd cool off there, and I'd come up with another game plan, and I'd line up another interview, and I'd go out that door after six beers, and I'd head to that interview, and before you knew it, I was out shooting up again, and I was the way pretty much every other week went. And I'd go off, you know, and die in some corner, in some far corner of San Francisco, hanging out with some people that were really shady, that, you know, I pretty much, you know, you can't lower your standards of living fast enough to keep up with the decline like it talks about. And that's pretty much what happened. Before you know it, I was calling my father, you know. And I wasn't asking him to help. It was to terrorize him. It was to emotionally hold him hostage, because I told him, I said, you either send me $500 or I'm going to go out and I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing. And I was graphic and explicit about, you know, how I'd been living my life. And that's how I showed up as a son one more time, except I gave my dad a good dose of it. And it hurt him, because he hadn't talked to me in 2 or 3 years. And my mother, she had recovered from cancer at the time. She had gone through chemotherapy and had operations and she recovered. So she's been fully recovered for 30 years now. She joined the Peace Corps. She got a spiritual awakening of her own. She's not an alcoholic. She has like one or two screwdrivers. You know, like by the second one, you know, it's like, Ma, are you kidding me? What are you going to do with the rest? You know, I'm just getting thirsty watching you. And she would get tipsy and so I'd laugh and oh, I've had enough, you know, and I've got to drive or whatever. And I'm like, you sissy. And I'm like, you know, alcoholics, we watch people drink sometimes, and like a cat watches a human eat a tuna fish sandwich for you. You know, like that's their fourth sip in 15 minutes. You know, it's insane. I mean, it drives you nuts, you know. But so her drinking drove me nuts. That's why I had to drink to get over her drinking, you know. So what happened was is he didn't send me the money. He says, I'm sorry, son, but, you know, I can't do it, you know. So I go off and I continue to, you know, walk the path of slow death. And, like I said, I got picked up by the officers while I was climbing up this fire escape at this city hotel waiting for this guy to show up. And, you know, they were angels in disguise. You know, at the time, they interrupted my next run. And, you know, I'd been living on the streets. And, like, Judy asked me to tell the story, you know, how I survived and how I showed up at those clubs. As I'd wait in the laundromat, and I'd wait till some guy who was about the same size as me, and he'd throw his clothes in the dryer. And he had good clothes, cleaner clothes than I had. You know, I'd been up for 3 days or whatever. And, you know, and he'd go off to go get a cup of coffee when the dryer was going. And I'd go in and grab his clean clothes, and I'd have a free, clean set of fresh clothes to go out and try and prey on some, you know, innocent victim who was going to, you know, find out that I was, you know, just, you know, some lowlife who was hanging out at a bar with a backpack, you know. And, you know, I didn't show up too well in relationships and you know. What happened was is I got into San Francisco City Jail and I had a spiritual awakening, you know, detoxed and, what it looked like was I couldn't sleep, then I sleep, and I would wake up sweating, and I'd always have these nightmares, and I was a nervous wreck for a while, and It was election time, so I knew they were going to keep me in there because they were doing a street sweep. I had this felony conviction for drug distribution. For some reason, they didn't like that, you know, type of behavior. And I when I got busted, I really thought that they were the bad guys, you know. And I thought, you know, I'm just trying to help people have a good time. And I really honestly believed that because I thought if you saw these people 1 hour after they take what I sell them, you would be thanking me. Because they are having the time of their life, and that's literally the perception that I carried with me, and until the truth, the moment of truth came, and that's when, like, you know, thank God for those moments of clarity, and I get delivered from, you know, the state that I was in to you know, some place where I was safe and protected, and that just happened to be jail. And about 2 weeks into it, I'm talking to the guy who was on my bunk mate, and I knew him from the street, and he said, man, I can't take this. I'm having these nightmares. I'm trying to get loaded in my dreams, and I can't, you know. Something's missing, you know. And he says, maybe that's God trying to tell you, you know, it's time to stop. And it hit home. I don't know. It was just the most profound, simple statement from somebody that I'd recognized, and it hit home. And right there, something welled up inside of me to ask for help, and that's what I did. I called my father, the one person, the one bastard I didn't want to talk to. And I told him, I said, I'm in a little bit of trouble. I'm going to be here for a while. I just want to let you know where I am. I'm safe. But I know that once they let me out of here, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to end up going back and doing the same thing I've been doing for the past 3 years, and I don't want to do that anymore. I can't stop. You know, and I was in jail, and I was obsessing and craving the next time I would be able to go out and drink the way I wanted to. And I knew that, you know, no matter how length of time, no matter how long of a time I spent in that place, the minute I got out, I was going to go back and do what I was aiming to do when they picked me up. And that's what happened. Was I stayed in there, and we lined up a treatment facility in Lynchburg, Virginia. That's how I got to Lynchburg. I got out. I had that plane ticket. I had nothing else. I had a set of clothes on my back and that plane ticket, because I put my stuff in this guy's garage, but I forgot where he lived, and I forgot what his name was. And I didn't even have a phone number. I mean, that's how I lived. I mean, you know, 2 years go by, I'm like, what was that dude's name? He's got all my stuff, you know. And I mean, literally, my whole apartment was in his garage, and boom. So I didn't care. At that point, it was my life depended on it. I knew I was going to get some help. I didn't know what it was going to look like or how it was going to come, but I knew if I didn't make that plane, I was doomed. So what did I do? I did like any good alcoholic. I took that plane ticket and used it as collateral and got some more stuff and partied the rest of the week. And then when I went to go look for the guy who had my plane ticket, he was nowhere to be found. So I like a good son, I called my mother and I told her one more lie, and I said I lost the plane ticket. She had to buy another one for me, $700. I said, no big deal, you know. So that's the kind of loser I showed up to. You know, one set of clothes on my back, I show up at the airport in Lynchburg, Virginia. And, you know, my poor sister, my half-sister, she hadn't seen me in 6 or 7 years. And she's 13 or 14 right now, you know, and I hadn't been a part of her life. And, you know, I'm just a wreck and miserably sober. You know, I probably had about maybe 24 hours without a drink or a drug, and I'm off the plane, and I'm just hating life, you know. I go from the grand, fun city of sin to this place where Jerry Fall runs the town, rolls the sidewalks up at 7 o'clock, and it's utter hell. You know, what do they do for fun around here? You know, so I'm sitting there like, you know, white-knuckling it, going to these outpatient meetings, and I met a guy who took me to my first meeting, and he introduced me to my first sponsor, and that's when the path began, and I went through the steps, and it was such a, you know, it was a life-changing experience when I did my first four-step, and I got honest with another human being like I'd never been honest before, and I went before my parents, and I made amends to my mother and my father, and I paid him back all the money I owed him, you know, and I told him I was wrong for, you know, for being such a lousy son, and I want to be, you know, you deserved a better son than that. And, you know, today, you know, Mother's Day, birthdays, my mother always gets the flowers at her door, you know, no matter where I am, she gets them at her door. She knows where I am. My phone number hasn't changed in the last 10 years. And what it looks like today is I'm a father, and my daughter's 16, and she's starting to experiment with the non-habit-forming marijuana, and I'm freaking out, and I'm talking to John like, you know, what do? You know, I can't be this drill sergeant and say, look, you don't want to end up like me. But, you know, I'm trying to be an open ear. And my sponsor today, he's been the same sponsor I've had for the past 8 years, and gone through the steps a couple of times with him. I've got guys that I sponsor today that are my lifeline, you know. I think the guys that I help and or try to help at least, or go through the book with and take through the steps, they keep me sober more than anything. You know, I go to meetings to find guys to help. You know, I don't go to meetings to, you know, hold on for dear life, because since I've gotten sober and I was shown that, you know, this is into action, not into thinking, you know. This is where we come in and we take actions to get sober, you know. I can't think my way into better living. And today that's pretty much been the mantra, you know. I went through a difficult time about 4 months ago and got out of a 5.5 year relationship, and, you know, it was topsy-turvy, and, you know, I did what my sponsor suggested. I'm back to a meeting a day. I'm calling him every day, and we have a great relationship, and I'm more active. I'm happier, and, you know, in my AA stuff than ever before, you know. And I've had the same home group for the past 10 years, and it's been a blessing. You know, we've gone through the highs and the lows, and sometimes you don't always agree, you know, and that's where the principles and the traditions come into play. And I've learned how to use those, and I've been an active home group member since day one. I've always had a job in that home group, and I think that's the one thing that saves me as well. So, you know, I have a business today that's thriving, and I've got guys that depend on me for their livelihood, and that's what I pray for. I ask God to help me meet my obligations to these men that have trusted me with their lives, because that's what they've done. And I wasn't that kind of a guy a while back. You know, I was the kind of guy that would take advantage of people. I was a taker, not a giver. And I came in here and I learned how to be a giver and not a taker. Not every day do I wake up and do it perfectly, but what I do is I make that a part of my daily routine. And I answer the phone when someone calls. And what happens today is when I start to think that life is treating me unfairly, or that I'm getting a tough break today, you know, because things just didn't happen the way I thought. You know, all I have to do is go to that meeting I go to every Thursday, and I go take this meeting at the Chesterfield County Jail where I did my last little visit. And I just had to check in. You know, I have to do it in every state that I rest in. I mean, I've done it in Colorado, I did it in Connecticut, New York, California, I had to do it in Virginia. I mean, you know, just had to christen the state. And so, you know, what happened was, is I go there every Thursday and I carry this meeting into these guys, and they look forward to seeing me, and I look forward to seeing them, and I tell them this is my favorite meeting of the whole week. And one of the guys I'm sponsoring now, he got released a couple months ago, and it's been a blessing to be a part of their lives. And I think that's what AA has taught me, is that, you know, to watch people recover and grow. And you know, when I came in here, it was all about me. Where's mine? Where's all my stuff? You know, I need my stuff back. Where I lost it all. Where's my stuff? You know, and I was very selfish and self-centered. I was until about maybe a half hour ago when I said a prayer, and then I got wiped as white as snow. Right? You know, it's a daily reprieve, believe me. But what I do get is it's freedom from self, the bondage of self, when I do these things. And that's the same thing that alcohol did for me every time. It gave me that freedom from bondage of self. And I think that's why people say alcohol wasn't the problem. It was just your solution at the time. And a lot of people say alcohol saved their lives. It saved them from, you know, suicide or whatever. And I can see how that makes sense, because it probably, in a lot of ways, medicated me until I got to a spiritual solution that would actually work for me in my life. And today, this allows me to walk freely and live happily, you know, to the best I know how. And I can do it amongst a lot of people, wonderful people that, you know, I get to share this with. And I don't get that anywhere else, you know. The people I hung out with before, they didn't care. I'd get locked up, they didn't care. They were just like, don't tell them you were with me, you know. Don't tell them anything about that, you know. It was like, you know, is the statute of limitations, you know, run out, you know, before I go make these amends. That was my concern when I came in here. And I've gone before some people that, you know, I really thought would either, you know, call the cops or kick me out. And I was telling John, I'm going to tell you a story about an amends I made. A couple of them. One of them was in this restaurant where I was bartender. Before I got sober this last time, I was bartending. It was the only job I could hold. And they they didn't give me health insurance. So I was pissed off about that. So I stole from them. And I take liquor and I throw it in the garbage can. I take it out the dumpster. You know. Anyways, I went back and I made amends. I've got a construction business. And I was doing some remodeling in his restaurant. This is 2 years later. I'm sober now. And I'm on eighth step. My sponsor says, it's time to go talk to him. I said, I'm doing work. What if he doesn't pay his next invoice? I'm broke. I've got a mortgage to pay. You wouldn't have a house if you weren't sober, would you? No. Okay. Are you going to do this? You might drink again if you don't. Okay, I'll do it. And my sponsor would always hold that over my head. He's like, you know, anytime I'm ready to buck and I'm like, I don't know if I really want to do this. It's not the right time. I don't know. This is really bad. This is not going to work. I can tell you right now, it's not a good time to do this. Maybe wait till I'm finished with the job and I've got the money already, you know? And you know how we think. I mean, it's just like, well, how I think. I don't know how you think, but that's how I came in here. He says, why don't you just go talk to him and tell him what you did? I said, okay, I'll do it. So I told him, and about halfway through the conversation, I said, you know, I was wrong. I was a lousy employee, blah, 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 blah. He, you know, and I said, you know, I stole from you, and I took, you know, a lot of liquor. And my sponsor asked me beforehand, he says, well, how much was the value of that liquor? I said, $750. He says, well, no. Was that wholesale or retail? I said, wholesale. He says, well, how much would that be worth retail? I said, probably about $1,500 at least, you know. He said, well, that's what you need to pay him back. Because you didn't just steal the liquor from him, but you stole the profits he would have made from that liquor. So that made me mad. So what happened was, is I go and I tell the owner of the restaurant, and I'm sitting there. Meanwhile, I just submitted an invoice the day before, and I'm, oh my God, he's going to kick me out. I'm not going to be able to afford a mortgage. Mortgage is due in about a week and a half. I'm not going to be able to pay him. All this noise is going through my head. And he says, well, wait, tell me how you stole this stuff. I said, well, I used to throw it in the garbage can, take it out the dumpster, put it around behind the dumpster, and then after work, I'd go out and get it. So, wow, that's amazing. Nobody's ever been that honest with me before. I really appreciate that. And I was like, wow, this is going strangely. And he says, you know, my son, he's been down in Florida for the past 3 or 4 years, and he's really having a bad time. He can't stop, and he's doing, you know, he's just like you, but I'm so glad that you're on this path. And it gives me hope. You know, that maybe my son will get what you've got. I don't know what's going on, but I really appreciate it. But I'll tell you what, just take a little bit off your bill each week when you send me an invoice and work it off. And I thought, well, I wouldn't have figured that one out in 10 years, you know? So right there, it was kind of like, okay, this is how God works. You know, when I'm willing to do his work, he's willing to take care of me. And I guess that's how it's always going to work. You know, if I'm willing to take care of God's sins. And this man, you know, to this day, he's still a friend of mine, and I've patched up a lot of relationships that I were damaged, probably because I resented or feared them, you know, in the first place. And those fears kind of dissipate when I go through those amends process. And to me, that's when I started to come to understand a God that I didn't understand before. When I came in here in the beginning, I prayed to a God I didn't understand. Just because you said, you know, that's what we need to do. We need to get a relationship. I thought God brought me here, and, you know, these steps bring me closer to God. And that's what my goal is to, you know, try and carry out that will, and I don't always do it perfect, but if I stay close to this, and this book, you know, it's falling apart, but my life is definitely held together and through all these principles, and I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to say, the gifts, you know, they only continue if I continue on this path. And if I don't continue on this path, it's like going up the down escalator. For a guy like me, I don't know about you. Maybe some people stop doing the steps and they get better. I don't. But when I continually engage in doing this stuff on a daily basis, it seems like my life just seems to carry through in ways that I normally could not have figured out. And I experienced that first when I was doing my 9-step amends, when I absolutely couldn't figure out how things would work. You know, when the finances, when you know, and that was just a small one, because I mean, there was others, but when things seemed to be unbearable or too much for me to handle, and it's just too much for me to conceive, and that's, you know, it's like me trying to understand God. It's too much for me to conceive. I don't know how that works, you know, but it's not up to me to figure out how that works. It's up to me to figure out how this works, and if I'm willing to help, if I'm willing to show up and do what I'm asked to do in here, it seems like my life out there just keeps getting better. And it has since I've been here, and there's no denying that. I mean, this is a life way better than I deserve, and like most people will share, you know, I come in here and I do a little bit of work, and I'm overpaid. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much. That was really great. I really appreciate it. Okay, so as I promised earlier tonight, we are self-supporting and we'd like your help with that if possible. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While the contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, which is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of the contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. And tonight we'd like to give you an opportunity to make any announcements of any AA activities that are going on, sponsored by your home groups in the back, in the green. Okay, thank you. Yes.
Thanks, Kyle, an alcoholic.
Kyle.
Virginia State Conference of Young People in AA is going to be having a hike June 13th in Charlottesville. This hike is open to all ages and all alcoholics. If you're interested, please talk to me after the meeting. We're going to go to a meeting after the hike. VistiPod, its acronym, is looking for subcommittees in different cities. It's in a new city this year, and they're trying to have people do the exact same thing that I'm doing right here. It's just announcing it until we need it. So if you're interested in getting involved and helping out, please talk to me after the meeting. If you're interested in hype, please talk to me after the meeting. Also, one of us who is having some health issues cannot go out to meetings, so I'm trying to arrange to be taken to her with some health things that are going on. And so if you're interested in bringing a meeting to somebody, please talk to me after the meeting. We're trying to arrange a good day. Thanks a lot, Sharon.
Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Billy. I'm an alcoholic. The 52nd International Women's Conference is coming to the Norfolk Waterside of Marriott next February, 11th to the 14th. I have flyers for anybody that's interested in registering. We are also in need of a lot of help, so if you want to get involved in service work, see me after the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? That's it. Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, if you would please see one of us after the meeting, if the home group members would just raise their hands. And newcomers, if you related to what Justin shared tonight and you think you belong here but you haven't met many of us yet, we'd like to meet you. If you'd like to introduce yourself, we really would like to get to know you a little bit. So at this time, if you'd like to just give us your first name. Anybody who's new? Okay. We have a newcomer's packet that's in this red envelope, and they're up here on the table. So if you have a friend that needs that, or if you need that yourself, please pick one up. And we do have a literature table over here, and we have big books, and we have a lot of meeting announcements, and we'd be happy to talk with you over there. We also have an email list. So if you want to stay in touch with our group and find out what we do, the events that we host, we do have a website, and we will email you if you leave your email address with us. The website is simpleactions.net. Sponsorship. Sponsorship is vitally important, and it is yours for the asking. We urge you to not delay in that. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, all you have to do is ask, and the sponsor will take it from there. So if there's anybody in the room tonight that would be willing to be a sponsor to anybody in the room, if you would raise your hand. And then also, if you have questions about sponsorship, Leanne from our home group and Evan are both going to be up here tonight, and please do come and speak with them. Smokers, please use the can provided outside, and do stay well away from the church entrance so that we don't interfere with the other activities that are being conducted here tonight by the church, the parish members. And I do again want to thank Justin for coming down here tonight and for bringing John. Okay, and let's see, email list. We do need help picking the tables up tonight. And then one last thing before we go. We have some visitors with us tonight in our fellowship that are from a very far away place. So I'd like to invite them to introduce themselves if they'd like to.
Hi, I'm Julian, and I'm an alcoholic.
Welcome. We're so glad you came to join us tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, help with the tables, I said that, and we are going to pray together when somebody reads 164. Are you ready? You're not? John, come on up here. Come on up here. I've got the book right here.
Whoa!
You got to come up here.
Thank you, Miss Judy.
You're welcome, sir.
All right. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize... Hi, I'm John. I'm alcoholic.
John, alcoholic. Hi, John.
Okay. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find. And join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Okay, and I do, and we invite you to please come up and thank the speaker if you would tonight, if you feel so moved. And we'll say the Our Father together. Everybody wants to get up, and we'll do that.
Man.
I saw you in prison.
And all the chairs stay down. We got to put the chairs back the way we found them. Tables up, chairs down.
Thanks.
Who brought us here today?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.